Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Informal Courses for Adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Truth is a critical component of our legal system, but how often are the players in any proceeding acting in purely and indisputably honest ways? And what does it mean to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? Is it even possible? Stephen Lubitt is Williams Memorial Professor of Law at Northwestern University. He explores some of these questions in his new book, The Importance of Being Honest, How Lying, Secrecy, and Hypocrisy Collide with Truth in Law. Stephen, welcome to Think. Hi, Stephen. Welcome
Hello.
To Think. Hi. Not to be too Bill Clinton about all this, but I suppose we have to start by defining what honesty is. Is that right?
We do have to start by defining honesty, and it turns out to be tremendously difficult. I think the simplest way to deal with it is to talk about sincerity. That you're being honest when you think you're being honest, and you're not being honest when you know you aren't. But once we get to that point, it branches off in many directions, and they become very hard to follow.
And unfortunately, sincerity is often present. You write that it's not just the out-and-out liars who cause trouble.
Well, that's really what makes the issue so difficult. If all we ever had to deal with was liars, they would be hard to track down, but at least we would know what the answer is. Liars need to be caught and punished, and that's intellectually at least, or morally, a pretty simple prescription. But there are tremendous other impediments to telling the truth, even when people are doing their best.
So talk about some of the things that tend to get in the way of people telling the unvarnished truth.
Well, the most important one is cognition. When you think about the way that witnesses testify in court, what's involved when a witness testifies in court, if you break it into pieces, you realize it's a tremendously complex and error-prone progression. And I can break it down into 6 or 7 or 8 steps for you, each one of which introduces a new opportunity for error or slippage.
Sure. Let's go through some of those, because I think people can sort of understand the idea that first and foremost, you have to understand what you've actually seen before you testify.
That's right. The first thing is that a witness in a courtroom has to have been in a position to observe the events in question in the first place. You have to have had a standpoint or a line of vision or a viewpoint that lets you see what's going on. But that's not enough, because
right.
You have to have also been able to see everything, or at least the most important parts, without certain aspects of it being obscured or invisible to you.
Mm-hmm.
And then you need to know and understand what you saw. Sometimes things are quite unclear or indistinct. So that's step 3. Step 4 is that you must have perceived things accurately. So you're in a position to view, you view all or most of it, you think you understand what you saw, but your understanding has to be accurate, correct, it has to be placed in the relevant context.
Mm-hmm.
You must not have misconstrued or misunderstood any of the activity.
And then there's also the question of how much time might pass between the time someone observes something and then is asked to recall that event.
Right. I mean, we haven't even actually gotten to that point yet. There's another couple of steps in between.
Mm-hmm.
You have to avoid suppositions or assumptions about what you saw. And then you have to remember it by the time you're asked to retell it, with each of those 6 earlier steps firmly in place. But even remembering isn't enough, because you have to know how to put it in words. You can have seen it accurately. You can have understood it completely. You could remember everything that you saw, but still fail at choosing the correct words to convey your understanding to the judge or jury who will be called upon to make the decision.
And then, assuming that you have all those things, and it starts to sound more and more impossible that you can get something that's absolutely correct out there.
Well, you know, it is impossible, actually. It is impossible. Carl Sandburg said that the witness who swears to tell the whole truth has already told his first lie.
Yeah, and there's this idea that the dichotomy is not so much between honesty and dishonesty as between honesty and imperfection.
That's right. Of course, dishonesty is a serious problem. I don't mean to discount it, and I talk about it at some length in the book. But a much more serious problem, I think, is the difficulty of conveying accurately the things that one sincerely believes.
So given all these realities, Stephen, does the law as it exists today in this country, does it encourage honesty or does it encourage rule following that approximates honesty?
Well, the latter, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
If you recognize that pristine honesty, if you think that honesty has some component of accuracy to it, if you recognize that that's really an unachievable goal, then you have to start asking, well, what can we do? What kind of rules can we put in place that will get us close? A computer scientist would call that an algorithm. What sort of procedures can we set up that will serve the competing goals or the concurrent goals of sincerity, accuracy, and understanding? And there are other goals as well. I imagine we'll get to those. And the justice system then is premised on locating the best rules to achieve those ends.
Yeah, and of course, I guess the rub is that when you set up those rules with the best possible intentions, you automatically and unintentionally set up a system where you sort of tell people how to dodge the rules.
Right. Well, all rules are generalizations, right? Every rule is created to apply to a broad set of general circumstances. And in specific cases, they can be misapplied or they can apply imperfectly or they can lead to unpleasant results. And, of course, they're subject to manipulation.
Yeah, the book is really interesting because people are so willing and ready to pounce on lawyers as being sort of not entirely honest or being only honest according to the letter of the law. And yet you have looked at the problems that also arise with clients and particularly judges. Can you talk about judges, for example, in your opinion, sort of lose their ability to be honest with and about themselves?
I think judges, the phrase I use for this is that they have a self-reflection deficit, right? that judges, because, of course, they're judges, right? What do they do all day? They sit and make determinations about other people. And overwhelmingly, judges' decisions are final. A very small, almost minuscule number of judgments ever actually get reversed by higher courts. So judges come to think of themselves as great determiners of honesty or accuracy, and many of them, I think actually most of them, fail to understand how contextual their rulings are and how much they're depending. I don't mean this in a bad way, but rather in an inevitable way, how much they're depending on their own biases and experiences and preferences when it comes to making judgments. And so introspection really, really fails them. And I wouldn't call that dishonesty, or I wouldn't even call it hypocrisy. I guess I'd call it sort of semi-self-delusion ends up affecting judicial decisions top to bottom.
Well, it's such a tough problem because you need a system in which there is a great deal of respect afforded to people who are in these authority positions. So then we set up judges. We have them dressed differently than anybody else in the courtroom. They're the only ones who address the entire court at will. They even sit higher than anybody else. I mean, it seems hard.
Everybody stands when they come in.
Yeah.
If it pleases the court.
Right. How do you have one without the other?
Your Honor. Well, that's a good question. I think we have more of this sort of faux respect than we really need. Respect for the judiciary is earned by the way they act, and demanding these little sort of gestures of obeisance, I think, sort of a throwback to earlier times and really, in many cases, unnecessary. You know, there was a case of a judge not long ago, I think in New York, who got upset when there was a cell phone ringing in his courtroom. So he ordered everybody to stand. Whose cell phone was it? Nobody would say who it was. And so he ordered everybody in the courtroom held in custody for 4 hours or 6 hours because nobody would rat out the cell phone owner. Well, you know, you can just live with a cell phone ringing in your courtroom. I don't think justice is trashed. It may be better if there were no cell phones ringing, but most everybody else has learned how to live with that, and it would have been far better if that judge had done the same thing. It wasn't an assault on the actual dignity of the court. It was just an affront to the pretended dignity of a particular judge.
Well, it's funny. In a previous life as a reporter, I covered courts a lot. And when I first started, it occurred to me that a lot of judges sort of conduct themselves almost like high school principals, that they want to make sure that everybody knows what the rules are so that they don't have to waste time enforcing them as the process goes on.
Well, some of that's important, don't you think? Because everybody will get out of the room sooner. You know, things will get done and if they run smoothly and everybody understands the rules. And by the way, I'm not saying I'd be any better if I were a judge. I think there's a lot of human frailty involved, and it would simply be better if the people involved recognized that more often.
So one of the things that makes you crazy that we do down here in Texas is elect a lot of our judges.
Yeah, we do that in Illinois, too.
Mm-hmm. What's the problem with that? I mean, some of it seems obvious, but it also would seem as if these judges then have a responsibility to be somewhat self-reflective because they have to answer to the people who elect them.
In judicial elections in Illinois, tell me if I'm wrong about Texas, people tend not to know very much.
About the judge that they're electing?
About the judges on the ballot. The worst thing for a judge would be to become well-known. I think the only judges who have ever been denied re-election in Illinois have been the ones that who have made headlines. But in theory, you're right. In theory, if a judge was abusing witnesses or abusing litigants, that person could be answerable at the ballot box. And that's what makes judicial elections so popular. As you probably know, 38 states elect some or all of their judges. So you're hardly alone in Texas, although your elections are more partisan and more expensive.
So your contention is that people probably vote simply by party and then they just keep incumbents there.
People vote by party or by incumbency. Certainly that's the broad trend all over the country, except at the Supreme Court level. And only in the recent years have there been highly publicized and hotly contested elections for Supreme Court seats, Texas, Ohio, Illinois, West Virginia, Florida.
You write in the book a lot of interesting things about the Supreme Court of the United States. For one thing, recusals from particular cases, and they're much more common than people might imagine.
It's more common in one sense, and it's very much under the radar because it happens at a point before anybody is really aware of the case. Cases come to the Supreme Court on a discretionary petition. It's called a petition for a writ of certiorari, and the Supreme Court can decide which cases they want to accept. In recent years, they've only taken 70 or 80 out of about 7,000 or 8,000 petitions. And the recusals come very early in the process before the petition for review is ever granted. And there are probably 100 or 110, maybe 120 of those a year. That is when less than the full court votes on whether to accept a petitioner's case.
We'll talk a little bit more about those recusals in just a moment with my guest, Stephen Lubitt. He is Williams Memorial Professor of Law at Northwestern University. His new book is called The Importance of Being Honest, How Lying, Secrecy, and Hypocrisy Collide with Truth in Law. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, offering summer escapes from the everyday. Short courses start in June. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Stephen Lubitt. He is Williams Memorial Professor of Law at Northwestern University. His new book is called The Importance of Being Honest, How Lying, Secrecy, and Hypocrisy Collide with Truth in Law. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Stephen, why don't Supreme Court justices have to say why they're recusing themselves from a case?
Because they're Supreme Court justices. There's no other explanation. There's no statute that requires them to, and they've simply adopted a practice of not talking about it, except in extraordinary cases. I think there have been four or five explanations in the history of the Supreme Court of justices who have either chosen to step aside or remain in a case where there was some controversy about it. And frankly, I think it's one of the most inexcusable things the Supreme Court does. It baffles me. No one I know has ever been able to think of a compelling reason that they would refuse to explain. But when you're the Supreme Court, that's what you get to do.
Well, it is troublesome if you think about the amount of oversight that exists, thanks to the Supreme Court, over the executive branch and the legislative branch. There really isn't. We talk about a balance of power, but there really isn't any oversight, is there?
Well, no. As the late Justice Jackson said, we don't have the last word because we are infallible, but we are infallible because we have the last word.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Stephen Lubitt is my guest. Let's speak to Roderick in Dallas. Hi, Roderick.
Hello. How you doing?
Great. Thanks.
I was wanting to ask the speaker about the notion of lying by omission. If you're being honest in terms of saying, answering what you're asked, but not actually giving all the detail, is that considered lying by omission? And how does that play out in the courts? Or just in the actual notion of being honest.
Thanks for your call.
Okay.
There are two different answers to that. In the world of philosophy, lying by omission is the same as lying by words. They're treated more or less the same way. I think in Kant or Sisselbach, or if you read any of the many philosophers who have addressed the issue. But in court, it's different. In court, you're expected to answer the question and simply provide the information requested. And lying by omission exists, if it exists at all, only if your other answers have created some sort of reliance or expectation that you have then failed to correct.
Is that appropriate, Stephen? I mean, would we be bogged down and sort of unable to move forward if lying by omission were not permissible in a court of law?
Well, remember, when you lie in a court of law, you're committing a felony for which you can go to jail for 5 years. So if we took a broad view of lying by omission, then witnesses would never stop talking.
Yeah.
Because the danger of leaving something out would be so great that the default position would be to go on and on and on.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. Ed in Dallas writes, and he mentions not in jest, don't you think stripping the bench of sovereign immunity might just have some merit? And how can life tenure be appropriate?
Well, I think he means judicial immunity, not sovereign immunity.
Yes.
Well, I think stripping the bench of judicial immunity would be a very, very interesting experiment, and you would quickly determine how badly people wanted to be judges. This is a movement, by the way, that he obviously is part of, the idea that judges could be sued and subjected to damages or even imprisonment for making mistakes, for making erroneous rulings. Now, a judge can already, of course, be removed from the bench or prosecuted for bribery or fraud, but the end of judicial immunity would mean much more than that. It would mean that judges who made mistakes would be subject to losing their homes or their savings. When you think about it that way, I think it's a bad idea. It would be exercise a real chilling effect on the willingness of judges to take unpopular positions. And I'm sorry, what was the second part of the question?
Simply whether life tenure is possibly appropriate.
I think I actually think life tenure is a bad idea. Mm-hmm. It's in the Constitution for federal judges. All but three or four states have rejected it. So you can see that given an opportunity to reconsider, most of the overwhelming number of jurisdictions in the United States don't utilize life tenure. When the system was originated in 1787, people didn't live that long. So life tenure didn't result in 40-year careers on the bench the way it does now.
Yeah, so if you're appointed at 40, you might have 8 good years, and then you were out.
Well, maybe 15,
mm-hmm.
but not 45.
Mm-hmm. There are people who would argue that allows for, you know, the development of a certain kind of wisdom and autocracy.
It does, and I think that's true. The question is what do you sacrifice? And one of the things that you sacrifice is turnover. I think it's sort of interesting to look at turnover on the federal bench. Every January for about the last 30 years, the Chief Justice of the United States, Berger, and then Rehnquist, and now Justice Roberts, sends a message to Congress asking for higher salaries for federal judges. This happens like clockwork in early January. And every year they say, oh, we're going to have turnover, judges are going to resign, we need the wisdom of longevity, and we're risking that if we don't pay judges enough money. But in fact, on the federal bench, turnover is less than 1% per year. And I think most organizations would say that that's unhealthy. In corporations or educational institutions or, dare I say, public radio stations, people want turnover.
Everybody but the employees, yeah.
Through management.
Right.
Wants turnover of more than 1%. I'm not saying they want to fire people. I just mm-hmm. think it's good when people move on. They find other things to do. You fill spots with new ideas, and that's how the evolution of an intellectual process works. So if anything, I think there's not enough turnover on the federal bench.
And what does it take to remove a federal judge? You know, we've heard of judges being, you know, physically incapacitated for a long time. We've heard of judges still sitting on the bench when they were blind and had very serious problems. Not to say that those disabilities would prevent a judge from doing his or her job, but they certainly make it more difficult.
To remove a judge involuntarily, the only way is impeachment by the House of Representatives and conviction by two-thirds of the Senate for a high crime or misdemeanor. Now, there's some authority that extreme inability to perform the duties of office, drunkenness, for example, constant drunkenness, is sufficient for impeachment. One judge was impeached for drunkenness in the 19th century. But in the 20th century, only a handful of judges have been involuntarily removed, and only for the commission of crimes, bribery, income tax evasion, and things of that nature. Now, there is also, for federal judges, what is called the Judicial Discipline and Disability Act, which allows a lower court judge to have his or her caseload reduced or removed in the case of disability. That doesn't apply to Supreme Court justices, however.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Stephen Lubitt. His new book is called The Importance of Being Honest, How Lying, Secrecy, and Hypocrisy Collide with Truth in Law. Let's speak next to Mike in Grapevine. Hi, Mike.
Hi. First-time caller. Stephen, I've got a question as it relates to gamesmanship and hypocrisy in sports.
In sports. Well, I'll do my best.
Well, I can tell you, one of the worst days of my child-rearing career was when I had to sit down with my daughter and explain to her that in soccer, when she kicked the ball out, she knew she kicked the ball out of bounds, that she was to run after the ball, take it away from the other player if necessary, and run back in and try to throw that ball back in. The truth had nothing to do with it at all, because it's a team environment, and if you want to play team sports, you've got to put the truth behind you.
The ball was kicked out of bounds and the referee didn't call it.
The referee just basically, you know, they're coached, and I had to tell my daughter, it's up to you to go get that ball.
because it's up to the referee to call whether it's in or out.
Well, it's up to the referee. Okay, that is
the,
correct.
The classic answer in law is a quote from Samuel Johnson in the 18th century, who was asked how you can argue a case if you don't believe that your side should win. How can you argue a bad cause was the question. And Johnson replied, you don't know whether the cause is good or bad until the judge pronounces it. And a case that you think is bad, the judge might think is good, and that's why you have the duty to your client to put it before the court. I'm not sure about youth soccer, but you know, your daughter could be wrong about whether the ball was out of bounds. So if you fail to go after it, you could be letting down your teammates based on your own misperception, and you're entitled to rely on what the referee saw. It's been 20 years since I had any kids in youth soccer, so I haven't given that much thought for a couple of decades, but that's one plausible answer.
Well, changing direction just a little bit, you have a very compelling essay in the book about the Virginia Tech shootings and how several problems, including confirmation biases made by well-meaning people who knew their jobs, may have actually cost a lot of lives. Can you talk about how that case illustrates the nature of truth and how it can be discovered or not?
Yeah, I think that's very important. It's part of what I was saying before, which is that our understanding of reality is inevitably influenced by our flawed perceptions. So the way we understand what we see is influenced by everything that's happened previously in our lives, and that is not avoidable. Cognition scientists have identified a whole series of what they call perception biases or cognition errors that are very common, upon receiving information, people think they understand what's going on, but in fact they're making mistakes, and very common and typical mistakes. Well, if you recall what happened at Virginia Tech, there was a shooting in a dormitory early in the morning, and one of the victims was a young woman. I think she was even a freshman, 18 or 19 years old, and then a resident advisor was also killed. Well, the police responded almost immediately to the gunfire, and they have their own set of perception biases, and one of them is that whenever a young woman is killed, the first suspect is a boyfriend or significant other. And that's because, very sadly, most of the time, that's true. So they immediately began interviewing the victim's roommate and said, did she have a boyfriend? Well, yes, she has a boyfriend. Does the boyfriend have a gun? Yes, the boyfriend has a gun. So now we have two perception errors happening at once. The first one is called availability error. That is, the police had available to them at the top of their minds the idea that the likely killer was a boyfriend. And then they said, well, does he have a gun? The answer is yes, he has a gun. And that's called confirmation bias. When you start thinking in a particular direction, you get one piece of information that confirms your initial inclination. Well, that locks it right down. You say, you jump to a conclusion and say, well, that must be the story. So they immediately went off racing after the boyfriend, who, of course, had nothing to do with it. And because they thought they had confirmed their initial supposition, no warning was issued to anybody else on the campus. Classes weren't canceled. There was no perimeter. There was no additional law enforcement. There was no lockdown of the campus. And, of course, we know another 30 people were killed because the shooter had no prior relationship to the first woman who was murdered.
And, of course, we can look at that now and say, well, how did they not figure that out? Why would they stick with the information they had from before when in fact, they hadn't yet solved the crime? But it's not such an odd leap to imagine that almost anyone in their place would have done the same thing.
It's not an odd leap, and, in fact, I think almost anyone in their place would have done the same thing. If they hadn't done that, they would have done something else. I don't mean to be critical of the police, who did the best they could with the information at hand, and what can you say? 99 times out of 100, they would have been right.
Well, and where I'm going with this is the idea that, you know, we want people to avoid making these false conclusions, accidentally or not. But the truth is that attorneys really count on jurors forming, if not false conclusions, conclusions based on limited evidence, don't we?
Well, the job of the lawyer is to figure out in advance what conclusions a judge or jury will jump to based on certain information, and then produce or question or arrange that information in order to lead to the desired conclusion.
Is that an inherently dishonest process?
That's a great question. I would say it's an inherent process. I don't know what the alternative would be.
Yeah.
You say, well, lawyers shouldn't take preconceptions into account. Well, that can't be right. So the alternative is to take them into account. It's the reason we have lawyers on both sides. It would be a terrible system if only one side were represented, but it turns out to be a pretty good system when both sides are represented. By the way, that's why the capital defense system in Texas should get more money.
Because you
need good lawyers on both sides in order to make sure that biases don't control outcomes.
Well, and I guess there's...
That's a plug for some former students of mine.
are they working on defending people who are on death row?
Not currently, but in the past, yeah, in Texas specifically.
We'll have more in just a minute with Stephen Lubitt. He is Williams Memorial Professor of Law at Northwestern University. His new book is called The Importance of Being Honest, How Lying, Secrecy, and Hypocrisy Collide with Truth in Law. We'd love to hear from you in this conversation. You can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, offering summer escapes from the everyday. Short courses start in June. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is the author of a book called The Importance of Being Honest, How Lying, Secrecy, and Hypocrisy Collide with Truth in Law. Stephen Lubitt is Williams Memorial Professor of Law at Northwestern University. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So before the break, we were talking about the importance of having equally qualified legal teams on both sides of an issue, or on all sides if they happen to be there. But I'm wondering if that assumes incorrectly that you'll get closer to the truth and closer to justice when all interested parties have equal access to legal counsel. In other words, if everybody's trying to maximize the outcome for their client, is there any reason to believe that they will hit on something that's the closest to what should happen?
If there were a way to validate the system, right, that's what you're talking about, we take it on faith, or at least lawyers do, that we get closer to truth when everybody is presenting their best
right.
Best argument. And if there were a way to validate that, to prove it, well, we would use that other system instead. You know, the problem is that these are the truths that we deal with in law aren't scientific. You know, you can't do multiple experiments or double-blind clinical studies to find the answer. And so you have to rely upon some intuitions about truth-seeking. And the one we have chosen to rely on is the adversary system, where each side presents its strongest case. The one thing that you do know, I think with some reliability about the adversary system, is it probes for weaknesses.
Yeah.
It's not so much the presenting your own best case as attempting to find the weaknesses or the soft spots in the other side's best case, that brings reliability to the system.
You have a section in the book about academia and how it plays into all this. I'm wondering for you as a professor, if it's frustrating to have these sort of idealistic young law students come in who...
And then we beat it out of them.
Well, who look to you hoping that you'll have all the answers, that you'll be able to tell them why it works and why we should believe fully in our system of justice.
Actually, as you might tell, I believe pretty deeply in our system of justice. I think we do most of the time a very good job, and I think we're able... the rest of the time, at least, to identify where the problems are. So I believe pretty strongly in it, and I don't find it very frustrating at all.
But
to talk to students about that, I guess they might find it frustrating because the reality they confront when they graduate is probably a lot more unpleasant than the picture I paint for them before they while they're still in school.
So in other words, you can sort of set them up to go out there before they've had exact situations to have to work all of this theory into.
Yeah, but I will tell you one thing. Even in the world of sort of commercial litigation, which is where most of my students end up, representing one large corporation trying to shift money out of the treasury of some other large corporation, you know, even then our system really respects the value of autonomy. And the respect for autonomy makes our country freer, it makes our country more prosperous, it makes our country easier for people to live in, and those are very good things. So we sometimes have to swallow our frustrations, I think, and look at the positive side of the judicial system.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Jim in Dallas. Hello, Jim.
Hi. Yeah, earlier a comment was made that judges serve for life unless they commit a high crime or misdemeanor. That's, I know, popular to reread the Constitution to say a lot of things that it doesn't say. It doesn't say that. It says they serve for a tenure of good behavior. Your author can't possibly be arguing that a high crime or misdemeanor is the only violation of the standard of good behavior, and certainly the founding fathers that wrote those words didn't mean that.
Well, the mechanism for removing judges is found in the Constitution. It says impeachment, and it specifies impeachment for high crimes or misdemeanors. Later, actually elsewhere in Article 3, it says that judges shall serve during good behavior. The long, unbroken precedents interpret the good behavior clause to be interpreted in light of the impeachment clause, and the impeachment clause applies only in the case of high crimes or misdemeanors.
Since impeachment and high crimes and misdemeanors have come up, let's talk for a minute about the Clinton sex case.
Okay.
Which was very much about truth, at least on the surface. But as you point out, there never was an underlying crime to discover in all of that testimony. They were never looking to see whether or not there had been a crime committed between Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky.
Right, or between Bill Clinton and Paula Jones, actually, mm-hmm. would be the more... More relevant example. Right, Clinton at most was charged, not at most, Clinton was charged with a really awful and I think despicable act of sexual harassment. It wasn't a crime. Nobody ever suggested it was a crime. And then in the course of his deposition in the Paula Jones case, he lied about his involvement with Monica Lewinsky. He lied first to his lawyer, his own lawyer, in their preparation for the deposition, and then when the question came under oath, he lied under oath about what he had been engaged with Monica Lewinsky. That was his downfall. If he had told the truth to his lawyer in the first place, things would never have gotten that far because his lawyer would have truncated the deposition before they ever got to the point where Clinton would have been tempted to tell the fatal lie.
Well, it's an interesting defense of the legal profession because we so seldom think about any sort of culpability for clients, but they're very often not entirely honest with their attorneys.
Oh, I'd say clients are dishonest. clients by orders of magnitude more frequently than lawyers. I mean, that's clients are operating out of extreme self-interest or self-delusion or self-importance or self-protection, and clients lie constantly, and it's almost always a bad idea for them. Witness the Bill Clinton case. It's a lawyer's job to try to break through that and encourage their clients to tell them the truth, because a case can almost always be defended better when the lawyer knows what's going on.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Stephen Lubitt. His book is called The Importance of Being Honest. Let's go next to Lydia in Dallas. Hi, Lydia.
Hi. I had a couple of questions going back to tenure, and you may have already addressed them. I apologize. But with a background in academics, I've always accepted tenure as really the mechanism that allows, for example, researchers to continue with work that might offend or be egregious to other forces that do change in a university. And I've always, you know, applied the same deference to the Supreme Court. You're able to grow and digest the Constitution and all the laws and apply them more effectively, perhaps, when you, you know, are in attendance for your lifetime, I guess. So if you could address that. And also, I had a question about questions that Supreme Court justices ask, or a failure to ask questions. I read a book recently, The Nine, whose author I can't recall, and it was absolutely fascinating.
Jeffrey Toobin.
But, I'm sorry, but they mention, or he mentions in the text, that Thomas has not asked any questions. In fact, I don't think he's ever asked any. And that comment kind of posed in my mind, well, is it a disadvantage? Is it a failure on his part to not comment or to not try to tax the lawyers to defend their positions? And I'll take your comments off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for your call, Lydia. We should start with this, Stephen. Are you tenured yourself?
I am, yes, and you're not going to hear me criticize. You're not going to hear me criticize it. There are thousands upon thousands of academics in the United States, tens of thousands. And there are only about 900 federal judges. So the system's very hard to very hard to compare. But I think that that a term in office of 10 or 12 or 14 years for a Supreme Court justice, as a colleague of mine has suggested, 18 years, would achieve the same level of independence without running the risk of superannuation and ossification, or that I think that we get on the Supreme Court currently.
And as to the question that arose after Jeffrey Toobin's book about justices
about Justice Thomas
questions.
Not asking questions, well, I think that's the best thing about Justice Thomas is that he doesn't ask questions. Quite often the grilling before the Supreme Court isn't information seeking. It's the justices sort of arguing with each other in front of the lawyers, and the lawyer is sort of a hapless foil for the justices' statements that are only vaguely in the form of questions. And Justice Thomas says he just doesn't care to do that. It doesn't help him decide the case. And when there's something he needs to know, he'll ask, which turns out to be two or three times a year. I think that's... I'm not a fan of Justice Thomas's generally, but I think that's refreshing.
Is it arguably useful to the other justices to have these public arguments or statement-making sessions? Is any one of them changing the mind of the other?
It's pretty hard to see that happens. I mean, maybe it happens now and then. They have conferences immediately after the argument, you know, so anything they said out in court, they could have said, they could say to each other afterward. Mm-hmm. It does give the public an idea of what the justices are thinking, so I suppose that's got some benefit.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Heath in Rowlett. Hi, Heath.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Great, thanks.
Professor, I got a question for you. You did touch on the fact that you see elections of judges here in Texas and in Illinois, I believe. The one thing that the first year of law school has taught me is that every solution comes with a whole other set of problems. So I was wondering, what's your solution if you don't want them elected or appointed?
Well, that's very astute. It's hard to say what the outcome would be of switching from an electoral system to an appointive system. Some states follow what they call the Missouri Plan. I'm sure you've heard about it, where judges are initially appointed, and then they have to face a retention election every 6 to 8 years, I think. Some states have commissions that make recommendations to the governor of three names for each vacancy, and then the governor can only select, obviously, one of the names from the particular list. Tennessee, at the moment, has no system at all. Their system of judicial selection expired, and the legislature hasn't adopted a new one. So that's a real experiment. I think there's something to be said for judicial elections, actually. So I'm not really promoting one form over another.
What is the relationship between good trial lawyers and improv theater?
The relationship is that in both cases, you're trying to create a group mind where everybody in the room, either the audience or the jury, is engaging in the same set of assumptions and suppositions and imagining the same set of events into which new information is going to be plugged. And in improv theater, when you get everybody thinking in the same direction, the result is laughter. And in a trial, when you get everybody thinking in the same direction, the result is a verdict and sometimes laughter.
How would you improve our legal system to encourage all parties to be more honest or to make it easier for them to be more genuinely truthful?
The best thing would be to make counsel more broadly available. I think no one's going to believe this, but what we need are more lawyers. I know everybody thinks we have too many, but what I think is that we have too few. If there were more lawyers, legal services would be less expensive, more available, more people would have access, and I think actually it's lawyers who bring the most truthfulness into the legal system.
So should we make it easier to get into law school?
We should have more law schools. We should make it easier to get into law school.
Stephen Lubitt is Williams Memorial Professor of Law at Northwestern University. Great school, not easy to get into the law school there. His latest book is called The Importance of Being Honest, How Lying, Secrecy, and Hypocrisy Collide with Truth in Law. Stephen, what a great hour. Thank you so much for joining us.
This has been a real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.